From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now, and we're following breaking news today, including that basketball star Brittany Griner has been sentenced in a court in Moscow to 9 years in prison for possession of a drug she uses legally in the U.S. for pain. We're going to take that up later in the program, but we want to spend a few minutes this hour on the momentous news this week in Kansas that voters overwhelmingly chose to protect abortion rights in that state. How is that ricocheting around the political landscape?
This was the first time an abortion question was on a ballot since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June. There are more referendums to come. The question is, how are the two major parties reacting to this news? Because you know they are rethinking their strategies going into the midterms and beyond. Let's bring in our political strategist. Alice Stewart is a Republican. Alice, welcome back.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Robin. This is Alice in Alexandria.
Hi there.
Oh, very nice. And we have Chris Scott, Democrat. He is Chief Political Officer for Democracy for America. Chris, welcome to you.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Robin. I am also calling in from Alexandria.
Okay. Well, Peter's all right. In Arizona and I'm in Boston. So there, we're all...
And Chris, I want to start with you because, listen, this referendum in Kansas, it didn't just squeak by. It was nearly a 20-point landslide. Turnout shocked Democrats and Republicans. Be honest with me. Did you see it coming?
Yes, I don't think I saw the margin being as large as it was, but I think it's definitely a pleasant surprise. Look, I think it just proves abortion access isn't just a morally right issue. It's an issue that Democrats have to lean in on politically. Anytime that you win in a state that went nearly 15 points for Trump, and then it goes 20 points for abortion activists. It tells you this is no longer a 50-50 issue that Republicans have been trying to say that it is. It's a 65-35 issue, and that Americans want to protect this right.
We're going to get into sort of what it means down the road, but Alice, I want you to reflect on the results here for just a moment, because even in the reddest parts of Kansas, anti-abortion voters underperformed. What'd you make of all this?
I have to say I was a little different than Chris in regard to the turnout. I was surprised at the large turnout. But again, it does show that this is a motivating issue. And the results we saw out of Kansas on this issue was clearly a pick-me-up for the pro-choice movement and a wake-me-up for the pro-life movement, as we're on the heels of the Dobbs decision, which did away with Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. And look, I think this is something certainly for both sides to look at this as an issue heading into the midterm elections. But you have to remember, this was unique in that this was a constitutional amendment on the ballot that would open the way for removing access to abortions. In the midterm elections in November, there are only about four states that have an actual abortion-related ballot initiative on the ballot. So this is unique in that regard, and that this is specifically outlined. Aside from that, as we head to November, voters are going to be looking at issues aside from abortion. They're going to be looking at the economy, inflation, and jobs, and crime. So I'm not going to go out as far as to say this is going to be a certain referendum on what will happen in November, but it certainly is a wake-up call and a rallying cry for the pro-life movement to activate and engage voters.
Well, and Alice, you're right that, you know, this is just, they were voting on a referendum, which is a very pointed question, but their vote reflected the polls across the country that Americans are, you know, largely in favor of keeping some form of abortion right in place. And you're speaking of it as a wake-up call. Some are saying maybe a wake-up call for the White House. President Biden issued an executive order yesterday to ensure people can travel to other states from the states that have already banned abortions. And he spoke about Kansas. Let's listen.
In a decisive vote, in a decisive victory, voters made it clear that politicians should not interfere with the fundamental rights of women. And the voters of Kansas sent a powerful signal that this fall, the American people will vote to preserve and protect the right and refuse to let them be ripped away by politicians. And my administration has their back.
Alice, we've spoken so many times. We know you call yourself pro-life. But do you think your party misjudged how many women in particular may also be against abortion for themselves, but they don't want the government telling them what to do with their bodies? That's a firm Republican belief. Or telling their daughters what to do. Do you think this was a misjudge?
I'm very pro-life. I believe in protecting the sanctity of life. I am not an advocate for abortion, except in the cases of rape, incest, and life of the mother. It should never be a first resort. It should be a last resort for a woman that has an unwanted pregnancy. But my position all along with regard to Roe v. Wade is that this decision, this important decision, should not be in the hands of 9 unelected justices. It should be in the hands of elected officials at the state level. And look, I don't like the results that came out of Kansas, but I do appreciate the fact this is closer to the people. And if this is the will of the people, then so be it. But there is also polling out there that shows that Americans do want to have some restrictions on abortions in terms of late-term abortions. They want to make sure that there are protections for that. And those in the pro-life community are really going to make a concerted effort to expose the extreme Democratic policies dealing with abortion and also advocate against any nationalized abortion that expects taxpayer funding of abortion. So those are the issues and the ways that the pro-life community will look at this moving forward.
Well, and Chris, I'm wondering, some Democrats have been, including the president, have been criticized for not being more vocally pro-abortion rights. Do you think Democrats have to make a change going into the midterms?
So as I said at the start, I think Democrats have to lean into this issue. I think, again, Kansas shows us that. To look at Alice's points, the only people that have been pushing forward extreme policies when it comes to this issue is the Republican Party. And I think when you get to November, this is bigger than the fact that, yes, you had a constitutional amendment being on the ballot. I think that this is very much a referendum. I think the people that are going to feel if abortion access is rolled back more are going to be galvanized, are going to be motivated. And that's
on
both sides
of the aisle. You say the Democrats need to lean in. What does that mean exactly? What do you expect them to be doing?
So I think when you look at President Biden, I think part of that criticism has been because he's been more reactionary to it. You look at the 2 executive orders that came. Activists wanted him to be more proactive in putting forth those things. And I think when you're talking about Democrats leaning in, it means not hiding from this issue, talking about it, making it a talking point, because it's a real life issues that a lot of people are going to have on their mind when they go to the ballot box on November 8th. It's not the only issue, but it's definitely one of the top 2 issues.
Right, Chris. And I hear that. I just want to ask you about something that we heard Alice say, which is that by November, you know, will this still be an issue? Will people be thinking more about inflation and the economy than they will about abortion? Do you think there's some truth to that, maybe?
I don't think there's a lot of truth to that. Again, it is not the only issue, but as long as you still have states that are trying to put in effect trigger laws, as long as you still have states that are going to be looking for loopholes of how they can get something passed through the legislature, which is a big thing right now because a lot of our state legislatures are Republican run, it's going to stay at the forefront of people's minds. And again, what I am saying is Democrats would be smart to make sure that it doesn't slip anywhere from the forefront of everybody's mind.
Yeah. Well, while we have you, I have a couple minutes here. And Alice, I want to ask, as you know, a lot of red states, Republican states, are going in the more extreme direction. We just have Georgia saying that they will now begin to count fetuses for tax purposes. They will count fetuses as human beings for tax deductions and maybe census counts. But that brings us to some of the other things that are happening in the news. This week, a federal grand jury subpoenaed Pat Cipollone, the former President Trump's White House counsel. We also have the ongoing Alex Jones story, the conspiracy theorist behind not just the terrible Sandy Hook lies, but he was also involved in the January 6th insurrection. We hear in his defamation trial yesterday, his lawyers mistakenly gave the prosecutors all of his phone texts for several years back. The January 6th committee will probably want them. My question to you is this. What about their followers, Trump's deep followers and Alex Jones followers, do you think your party has lost control to voters who will continue to believe the lies, who will continue to act on them, even if Trump is gone, even if Alex Jones is gone?
Oh, first off, let me say Alex Jones does not represent the Republican Party. He is a man that has said some really horrible, awful, bad things, and he deserves the bad lawyer that he has that turned over his text to the opposing counsel. Mm-hmm. And he deserves every bit of punishment that he gets from that.
But briefly, his followers are Republican. Go ahead.
But the key is what Republicans need to focus on. We don't need to focus on the false allegations of election fraud of the past and past grievances of 2020.
Yeah.
Republicans need to put that in the rearview mirror and focus on policies that will unite the country and also policies that will help us on the economic front and on the inflation front.
Alice
and put
Stewart,
away past grievances.
Alice Stewart, the Republican, Chris Scott, the Democrat, our strategist, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That will unite the country and also policies that will help us on the economic front and on the inflation front.
Alice Stewart,
past grievances.
Alice Stewart, the Republican, Chris Scott, the Democrat, our strategist. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How to help Kentucky. More than 1,300 people have been rescued from the flooding that's killed at least 37. The region is in a heat wave, though, without a lot of water or electricity. And the national response has been extraordinary. Donations pouring in, mostly money. But as people across the country are asking, what can I do? Lexington, Kentucky-based Chef Joe Arvin thought, I can feed people. He's brought hundreds of pounds of pork and beef, as well as canned food, bottled water, to Eastern Kentucky. Not an easy task. He sent us incredible pictures of what he saw there. We'll have them at herenow.org. But you may know Joe. He's been featured on Anthony Bourdain's The Taste. He's competed in cooking competitions. He has two Culinary Federation gold medals. He's also been on the bare-knuckle reality show Big Brother, so washed-out roads and down bridges don't faze him, although they've been making his work incredibly difficult. He joins us now. And, Chef, this is very tender. And it also goes to, you know, everyone knows everyone in Eastern Kentucky. You even tried to reach that young couple who horribly lost four children to the floods. You know members of their family?
Yeah, we had on Monday, we got the call that they were still trapped. They hadn't had food, water, electricity. It's painful. It's a painful time in Kentucky, in Eastern Kentucky. And if you haven't been to Eastern Kentucky, it's hard to understand these people. I mean, they're my people, and they've grown up poor. And poor is not a bad word, because these people, the strength that they have, the grit, the dignity that they hold in their hearts, and, you know, the stories like that that are coming out, that's just one. Mm. That's just one. We still don't know how many more are to come. We have search and rescue. We have eight roads right now that are covered that we can't get to people. We have 400 National Guard staying in the high schools in cots. We were able to feed the entire National Guard rescue crew, but they're out there. When I'm down there and we're passing out food in the towns, you see nothing but rescue. So right now it's a mission of finding people more than anything, because now we're going over a week, no food, no water, no electricity, most of them stuck in water, mud, trees, only searching for their families or their kids to bring them back.
Okay, well, how have you been able to help? Talk more about what you've been able to bring.
Yeah, I think that's some of the most uplifting things. This it was actually Thursday night. I was sitting on the couch with my wife, and we saw the story, and we looked at each other at the same time and said, we got to help. How do we help? Mm-hmm. And I literally tweeted out, being a chef, obviously that's what I do. I feed people, and that's my passion, and that's my heart. And in that day, by that evening at midnight, we had had $2,000. We went to Costco that morning, and we bought $3,000 worth of groceries, and we cooked for 30 hours straight without laying down. And we fed throughout the night. We had people coming from everywhere with stories of, you know, 3 days. They were on their third stay without any real food. These guys need more help. My big worry right now is that we forget, just like anything else. It happened a week ago. They're going to be hurting for a year. You know, Chris Stapleton is from that hometown. I don't know if anybody knows that, but Chris Stapleton was there yesterday by hand, pulling trees up, pulling dirt up. He went to Walmart. He bought thousands of dollars of things to help. The University of Kentucky basketball team actually held a benefit practice. So everyone's geared up to help. And I think that out of this, you can take that no one asked anybody's political affiliation. No one asked your religion. No one asked what you believed in or what you stood for. What they asked was for help. All were able to give that hand. It could have been just your hand to the next hand for a boxed lunch. That was that hand, didn't it? You had the hand that got it to somebody. And then we came home. We were out of supplies, out of everything. We needed some rest, so we slept the night. And it was coming Monday, and we didn't have the volunteers. Everyone had to be at work. We were out of supplies, out of everything. My wife and I took off work, and we just said, let's do it again. Let's figure what we can do ourselves. So then we called around to local restaurants. We got friends that I knew to donate food. We went to Popeyes. I bought 100 pieces of chicken, and then we cooked up a bunch of lasagna. And just my wife and I went and served, and we knew we couldn't do a lot because it would be the two of us. But we weren't there an hour, and 10 people walked up to volunteer with us, just with us for hours. They stood with us. They didn't have to be there. And it's just an absolute to see this kind of travesty, but to see also the hearts of those that want to help and get them back to whole, get them back all the way to whole, I think is just, I mean, that's what we live for, is to be able to see that type of humanity in today's world.
I'm thinking, too, that Chef Andres is there with World Central Kitchen. I have friends who are picking up and going from New England down to help. And yet, it's hard to go to Kentucky right now. It's really hard to get there. It's hard to get rental cars. What would you want? Do you want more people to come volunteer with you? What do you want?
I think right now, at this part in the mission, we don't know what's going to happen. As you mentioned, the heat waves are coming, the heat index, they have no electric. They're currently putting up little air-conditioned trailers so that you can get out of the heat for a little bit, or, you know, get you some water. But right now, going forward, supplies, and cleanup. The volunteers are still there. We're still getting a lot of that, but we're running out of the needed supplies, and we're running out of getting, I mean, every home that I saw was completely destroyed. I mean, looking like rubble. It was blown. You see roofs in the creeks. You see, I think the hardest part for me was seeing all the kids' toys and bicycles and stuff just running down the river. Whole homes. We saw parts where there would be like three buses, like they had been thrown so hard they were stuck into the rock of a mountain. And as you just said, getting in there, when we went Saturday, most of the roads were still closed. I have a Jeep. Oddly enough, as I went up one of the streets with my kids, half of the road fell off. The water had eroded it from underneath. So the roads are breaking in half and literally falling down the sides of a mountain.
And in your pictures you sent us, and again, they're at herenow.org, you've got, you know, people helping you trying to walk over what looked like pieces of concrete that used to bridge a river.
Yep.
SUVs are submerged. And that water, well, we know the danger of this current. So this is not for the faint of heart.
No, the military, they found 12 children, and they had to helicopter them out. They were stuck on the top of their house with nowhere to go. There are unaccounted people that you're not going to hear in the news. We went down to the breakfast shops, what used to be a breakfast restaurant there. I was talking to the locals, and the stories that we're hearing is that some of these people will never be found. I saw mud that would be 10 foot deep that has rolled down mountains and down cliffs. And as that mudslide would happen, it's taking entire houses with it, entire trailers, houses, everything in its way, it's ripping right through.
Chef Joe Arvin, it's just devastating to hear some of the things that are going on there. You know, thank you so much for talking to us about it. And I'm imagining, you know, that the best thing that people can do is you just send money. So you tell us people should send it directly to the Red Cross.
Yeah, it's our number one that's going straight to the Kentucky Relief.
Mm-hmm. We so appreciate you. We are heartbroken and yet buoyed by your continued optimism. So thanks so much.
Well, just know that out of all of it, we haven't even thought about losing hope. One lady was trapped with four kids in her trailer, so the water was rising around her, and she could see it coming up, and she said the floors in the trailer started popping and creaking, and she didn't know what to do. She knew they were going, and their dad was working down at the bottom of the river, and that's where he worked, so he wasn't home. And she knew that more than likely it was the end. So she thought, she ran inside and she cut the cord on her vacuum cleaner.
Oh, yes.
Wrapped it around her children with her and called her husband and said, look, the only thing I know to do is if we're going, we go together. They made it.
Yeah.
Hope is our strength. Love is our strength and our desire to bring everyone back together. We will rise again, and we will build. We'll build back better.
Yeah. Joe, thank you so, so much. I really appreciate it. Okay.
Thank you.
You take
and
care.
We're going to keep working.
Okay.
We'll see what we can do.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you, dear. Thanks for the time.
Yeah. Well, to see photographs from Chef Arvin's trips to Eastern Kentucky, go to herenow.org. And while you're there, you'll also find links to help Kentucky's relief efforts. Now, as Joe mentioned, the Red Cross created a local fund. We'll also link to a new online recovery site set up by Kentucky's Governor Andy Beshear, who says those funds will be used for long-term relief for families directly affected by this horrendous flooding. And as we're hearing today, after days of severe flooding in eastern Kentucky, that state needs cleaning up. Katie Myers of the Ohio Valley Resource reports from the city of Whitesburg.
In the Parlor Room, a downtown tattoo shop and music venue, the shop's art-covered walls meet a bare floor covered in mud. Rows of sketchbooks with the tattoo artist's drawings sit drying beneath a fan. John Falter works here.
The water pressure pushed the doors wide open.
Mud cakes the streets of this city. It's on everything. Shoes, cars, furniture piled outside of stores and houses. It smells like chemicals and gasoline. Fire Chief Perry Fowler says they can't get the mud off the streets. There's not enough water in the city tanks, and they're trying to conserve it.
We need the water, especially to spray mud out, that sort of thing. So we're going to have a tough time keeping the tanks full, but we've got to get the mud out just for health reasons, if nothing else.
The city's losing water to pipe leaks, which officials are working to fix. And the water is not currently considered safe to drink, if it's working at all.
The boil water advisory does stand in effect, and it will be quite some time before that's released.
And down the street, the destruction continues. Mud sits on top of the microphones and computers at the Apple shop. That's where I work. It's where, for decades, WMMT 88.7 FM broadcast out into the world, the voice of mountain people, as we say, Possum Radio. Meredith Scalos, the communications director, says the bottom floor of the building is unusable right now.
We are deeply focused on the initial phases of recovery right now. Our highest priority being archival recovery.
Apple Shop was home to decades worth of local history in film and audio reels, as well as books, posters, and art. Staff are salvaging what they can, gently rinsing mud from spools and spools of film in hopes of saving at least some of it. It's backbreaking and tedious work.
Because this is going to take weeks, months, years to recover, and, you know, community is all we've got.
In between shifts cleaning and mucking and drying, Apple Shop staff are volunteering at local shops and soup kitchens. Inside the Harry M. Caudill Library, people are exhausted. walking in to sit for a minute or just to talk with Alita Vogel, the head librarian. Sometimes she gives them a hug.
We are open, offering coffee and a place to just hang out, charge your phone.
The Whitesburg branch came out unscathed, but Vogel says libraries in smaller towns haven't fared so well.
I'll probably put on some boots and some grungy clothes and help clear out as much as I can. And then we'll just take it from there, one step at a time.
Outside, the mud clings to mail carrier Jody Holbrook's shoes as he makes his way through town. Everybody knows him from his usual route down Main Street.
We've got three carriers, but the other two carriers, one of them can't get here, and the other one, from what I understand, he lost everything he had. Nobody's even heard from him.
Holbrook knows a lot of people in this town. The parlor room, the library, apple shop, the apartments. He visits them all. The post office flooded, too.
I mean, there's no way to describe what all's piled up in there right now that we just can't deliver. I mean, a lot of my addresses, I pull up and the houses are gone. I'm sorry. But we'll make it, I reckon.
For Here and Now, I'm Katie Myers.
I'm sorry, Boston, but 100 degrees in August kind of feels like spring where I live. On the other hand, Robin, you know, you're right. A lot of the country has been sweltering lately.
It is very, very hot.
That is Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, who says the heat is complicating search and rescue efforts after the worst flooding his state has ever seen. The governor said today that the death toll is still at 37. Meanwhile, the city of St. Louis was battered by a historic rainstorm last week, with even more this week. Here's what the local news is saying about that.
We've had some heavy rain overnight. Highest totals right now coming in from Lake St. Louis with over 4.5 inches of rain. Even St. Louis
land. And the Pacific Northwest baked in another heat wave last week. Wildfires continue to burn across the West, which is locked in a 22-year drought. So you may be saying to yourself at this point, is all that extreme weather happening more often because of climate change? Well, scientists are increasingly saying yes, and they're using new methods to back it up. Meteorologist Marshall Shepard is a professor at the University of Georgia and director of its Atmospheric Sciences program. Marshall, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
So I just read a list of major events and weather catastrophes that are in the headlines right now. But if I had talked to you a couple of years ago, even, and I had asked you the same question, is climate change to blame? I'm betting you would have been pretty reluctant to say yes. Why is that?
Well, I think I would have been reluctant to say it's causation. I certainly, even a few years ago, would have noted that climate change is likely, but there would have been a bit more uncertainty, as you note, in my answer. I think where we are today in 2022, this generation of what we call attribution studies have improved. Techniques have gotten better. And so we are more confident now as climate scientists in attributing certain extreme weather events happening right now to climate change. And I think you're right. That is an advancement over the last 5 to 10 years.
And tell me about this new tool in the toolbox, rapid attribution studies. What is it exactly and how does it work?
Well, we have attribution studies, which are using observational techniques and models to try to essentially quantify what amount of DNA of climate change is in today's weather and climate events. And I co-authored a report for the National Academy of Sciences back in 2016 to assess where we are on that. And what we found is that for heat waves, drought, intense rainstorms, and to some degree, aspects of hurricanes and wildfires, we had varying degrees of ability to, with confidence to say how much climate change is likely influencing those things today. Now, there's a subset of these attribution studies called rapid attribution studies, which essentially means that scientists now, within days, can run experiments using their models or observational techniques to try to determine likelihood that an event was linked to climate change. We just saw that with the heat waves in Europe and London. A study is already out suggesting that that event was 10 or so more times likely because of climate change.
Well, in fact, I think the first time I remember hearing about this was last year when scientists said that the terrible heat wave in the Pacific Northwest, dozens and dozens of people died, that it was virtually impossible without climate change. So why don't you dig into one of those specific examples and tell us what we learned from them?
Yeah, the event that you're talking about in the Pacific Northwest, I believe the study suggests that there was a 115-time likelihood of that event occurring because of climate change, which is essentially suggesting that without climate change, the magnitude of that heat wave in the Pacific Northwest would not have been as severe. Why that's important and why we need such attribution studies is just like with London or parts of Europe, they're not equipped in those parts of the country like Portland with air conditioning in many homes or many businesses. And so when you have an infrastructure or a part of society that's fundamentally not expecting this type of weather, now you get to the so what of why it's important. It's not just a heat wave. This is just not some academic exercise to do these attribution studies. Policymakers, planners, and stakeholders need that information so that they can start developing resiliency, adaptation, and sustainability plans to mitigate what essentially is a new climate world or a new weather reality for us.
Well, and I think even people in the Portland area would say that many of them don't have air conditioning units as well. But what you said makes me think that this technology might not just affect public policy, but also the way that we communicate with the public about climate change, right? Because the message, if you're hearing about a heat wave in the news, for instance, and you know right away, unequivocally, practically, that this is related to climate change, do you think it lands different in the public ear?
I think it does land differently. And I tweeted out there a few weeks ago. I said, look, the visual media has to stop covering heat waves with pictures of kids eating ice cream or frolicking around in fountains. That's kind of an old, outdated way of portraying heat. Heat kills. It's typically in a given year in the United States is, if not the leading, one or two leading weather-related killers. And I think people may be surprised to hear that. They may be thinking about tornadoes or hurricanes or lightning. It's extreme temperatures that kill the most people. Mm. So we have to fundamentally raise the level of alert. Federal government just recently, the U.S. government, the Biden administration just released a new heat website, and that's a step forward. Even with the flooding that we've seen in parts of St. Louis and Kentucky and Illinois in recent weeks, that's a new normal climate system, not of surprise to many of us that warn that a warming climate would have more water vapor available to these storms and we'll get greater intensity in the rainstorms. That's the reality that we live in. And again, these attribution studies have shown us that we are seeing more intensity in the rainstorms in 2022. But the problem with that is that much of our infrastructure, our stormwater management, is designed for the 1960s and 1970s rainstorms, coupled with a greater amount of impervious surfaces, parking lots, and so forth. That's why we're seeing more urban flooding.
I think I heard you suggest in a previous answer that not all disasters are created equal. Is a tornado, for example, as likely to be connected to climate change as a heat wave or a hurricane?
Well, I will say that all of weather events are caused by atmospheric conditions. So I don't like to use causation. So a heat wave is not necessarily caused by climate change, but it certainly is being amplified or intensified by climate change. And so you're right. In our studies from the National Academies of Science, what we noted is that we have really high confidence based on scientific knowledge that heat waves, drought, intensity of rainstorms, and to some degree, some aspects of hurricanes are likely, well, not likely, have the DNA of climate change in them today. So that's what we know from an attribution standpoint. However, things like tornadic storms, it would be careless to say at this point in time that we're seeing more tornadoes because of climate change, which is what I heard after the December tornadoes last year, for example. The scientific literature just doesn't conclusively show us that yet. It would be careless to say that we're seeing more tornadoes because of climate change. We just don't know the answer to that part of the equation yet. Now, it turns out that we may end up finding that that's the case, but it takes a bit more in the attribution studies to get at that answer.
And to your doubters, Marshall Shepard, people who will always question expertise or facts, what do you say to defend the science behind these models?
Well, you know, what I would say, and that's a great question because it's certainly something, there are little pockets of doubt and contrarianism, but as a scientist, I'm someone that, you know, talks to the White House and the Waffle House, and I'm seeing a relaxation of that. There are little corners or pockets of it. I still get the occasional tweet saying, but we've always had heat waves and tornadoes. We've always had hurricanes. Climate changes naturally. I said, yes, I promise you that climate scientists like me that went through graduate programs learned that. However, I would also say that grass grows naturally as well, but when we fertilize the soil, that grass grows differently. So I try to remove this idea that it's either or, that it's natural variability or it's anthropogenic climate change. It's actually both. We now have a naturally varying climate system and weather that's being amplified or boosted by this human steroid associated with more fossil fuel burning and greenhouse gases in our atmosphere.
Meteorologist Marshall Shepard, a professor at the University of Georgia and director of its atmospheric sciences program. Marshall, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Researchers at Middle Tennessee State University are studying an endangered plant in a secret location. We're talking about wild ginseng, which is prized for its medicinal properties, highly regulated when it comes to cultivation, and not easy to find. But Steve Harouche of WPLN's podcast This is Nashville met up with plant scientist Ethan Swigert in the hunt for wild ginseng.
There's kind of a legend about ginseng that it shows itself to you, and if you're not ready, you won't find it. And so we had known about this patch, and we went and found it, and then one of our colleagues wanted to see it, and he spent about 3 hours, got lost back in here, and never found it. So the joke was like, well, you weren't ready.
For what it's worth, I feel ready. As we get deeper into the woods, Ethan points out the trees along the way, mostly pine and other evergreens. The ground is rocky, so Ethan says we're not likely to find ginseng here. But then something catches his eye, and it definitely looks like ginseng, at least to me. False alarm.
Now this is Virginia creeper here. It's a native vine, and people always will say, oh man, I've got like 5 acres of ginseng. And I'm like, no, you don't. 5 acres of ginseng, you're sitting on like $1 million. No way.
Virginia creeper is not worth anything. But if you've got wild ginseng on your property, now that's a different story.
Yeah, watch your ankles.
There are boulders everywhere. But soon the landscape begins to change. Less rocky, more maple trees. Signs that we're getting closer.
We're looking for a northeast-facing hillside. The way to find that is wake up in the morning and maybe around 9:30 or 10, look at where the sun hits, and that's a good spot to go and find ginseng. You want kind of a gently sloping, which as you can see is what we got here, and that'll help with drainage. They like to be well watered, but not soggy and not too dry. They're pretty persnickety, really. I like it just right.
By now, we've been out for an hour, which is about twice as long as Ethan thought it might take. And even though it's hot and muggy, honestly, the hike is pretty enjoyable.
Watch that. Yeah, talking to those old ginsengers, or sangers, going out singing, a lot of what they talk about is just the moments of spending time with like their grandfather or dad or whatever, and hiking in the woods, crawling under brush and stuff, just having fun.
But we came here to find ginseng, and it is not going well.
Man, I just feel like it's right here and I'm not seeing it.
This goes on for a while.
Let me check my GPS. I'm in these little pockets like this. It's good to kind of slow down a little bit and look for it. Nope, close. But that kind of shape is what you're looking for. So much Virginia creeper, it gets my hopes up. I think it is left here. Actually, maybe right. Let's keep going that way. If I remember right, this patch will be on this side.
Nope. Tricked me. But all this time on the trail is giving Ethan plenty of time to school me on ginseng. It's been cultivated for thousands of years for its medicinal benefits. Native Americans use the root to treat everything from headaches to infertility. High blood pressure? Take wild ginseng. Low blood pressure? Take wild ginseng. It's sometimes called a miracle plant, and that's because really it can be whatever you need it to be.
Almost like a cigarette. You might smoke it if you need it to get amped up. You might smoke it if you need to calm down, kind of get the same effect.
Right.
Or a different effect depending on what you want. Ginseng's kind of like that.
It's easy to see why it's so valuable. Ethan says the gnarlier the root, the better. Though it's nearly impossible to know how gnarly the root is from above ground. And in case you haven't put this together yet, it's nearly impossible to see, period, even if you know what you're looking for. Which, thankfully, Ethan does.
There, right there. There it is. Look at that. We walked past it twice. That's it. That's ginseng. That's four prong. That's a huge one. Good grief. Walked right past it. Ha! Told you, right? Like, if it doesn't want to be seen, it won't. We slowed down. We chilled out, and then boom. There it is. I almost stepped on it. But so you can see, these are the prongs. And these are, this whole thing is the leaf, and that's a leaflet. And then there, it's flowering. Man, I was getting worried. I was like, if I don't show him this dang plant, he's gonna think I'm a joke.
The ginseng is no joke. It's a beautiful plant, and it was hiding in plain sight. It's also an endangered plant. So after all this, we leave it right where we found it and head back.
Steve Harouche of WPLN's This Is Nashville podcast, hiking for ginseng with plant scientist Ethan Swigert. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. It's Here and Now.